Catherine Switzer became the first woman to officially enter and run the Boston Marathon in 1967. Ever since, she has blazed trails, been a champion for women's running, and inspired millions. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'll talk with Catherine Switzer about her running life. Then later on, something completely different. Terry Gilliam spent the first 12 years of his life in Minnesota, but he would go on to become one of the most beloved entertainers in British history. He's one of the founding members of Monty Python, the man responsible for the art and animation that defined the look of the group. He also has a new memoir out, Gilliam-esque. I'll talk with him. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. In 1967, Catherine Switzer became the first woman to officially enter and run the Boston Marathon. She went on to have a career as an elite competitor, winning the New York Marathon in 1974, coming second in Boston in 1975. She's championed women's running around the world and inspired millions of women and men. She spent last weekend in Des Moines for the Des Moines Marathon, and she recently founded a nonprofit, 261 Fearless, a global community of women who run and walk, and she is with me now. Hello, Catherine.
Hello, Charity. How are you?
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, great. I'm just delighted to be here, and I loved being in Des Moines last weekend. My gosh, what a fabulous event.
Well, and that event was the first co-ed event that has been sponsored by your nonprofit, 261 Fearless. 261, that's the number that you wore when you ran that first Boston Marathon in 1967. What brought you to Des Moines? Why Des Moines?
I came for the IMT Des Moines Marathon. And if you can imagine this, the race director, Chris Birch, invited me for the first time 5 years ago. And I said, oh, I'd love to come, but I'm really booked that date. And he said, well, how about the next year? And I said, you won't believe this, but I'm actually booked for the next 3 years. And he said, well, how about the fifth year? And I said, I'm free. I'm coming. So it was the longest booking he had ever made and the longest booking I had ever made. I was delighted to be the keynote speaker at the IMT Des Moines Marathon's pasta dinner. We had a wonderful time at the expo speaking, and also I was signing my books. But you're right, Charity, what really also excited me hugely is my new foundation, 261 Fearless, which is an empowerment movement to get women empowered and fearless through the act of running, through the vehicle of running. We decided to make IMT Des Moines Marathon our first Fearless Partner event, co-ed event. And it was great because it was a salute to that wonderful race after all these years that now has more women participants than men.
Well, I know that you have told the story of running that first Boston Marathon more times than you can count, but I do want to start there. For people, so many of us have grown up taking for granted that women can run in any event that they want to run in, and women can participate alongside men. Let's go back to 1967, 1966. As a woman who liked to run, what was the world like? I mean, what were your opportunities?
Well, you know, it's amazing because it wasn't that long ago. I suppose for somebody who is younger than I, it was a long time ago. But 1966, 1967, the longest event in the Olympic Games for women was an 800 meters, two laps around the track, because it was generally believed that if a woman did anything longer than that, or even that, you know, it was too arduous and too dangerous and that bad things would happen to her. She'd never have children. She'd turn into a man. And so women themselves were very afraid of doing any really strenuous participation. And men themselves also believed, you know, that that was an unfeminine thing for women to do, and they didn't want their girlfriends changing into men. And you know, these myths had been around for thousands of years. So the situation was when I began to run, and I began running at age 12, and we'll come back to early empowerment because I know you're involved with Girls on the Run, and it's a fabulous program. And my dad started me running at age 12 because he saw a little insecure girl who wanted to make the field hockey team in her high school. And I just loved the run, not so much because of the physical aspect, but because it made me feel so empowered. And when I went to Syracuse University, there were no collegiate sports at all for women. So I was running, and I asked if I could run on the men's cross-country team. Well, I could not because that was against NCAA rules. But they welcomed me to train with the team. And one of the volunteer coaches was a really older guy. He was 50, who had run marathons. And he inspired me to try to run my first Boston Marathon. He didn't believe a woman could do the distance either. He believed all the old myths. And when I showed him in practice that I could do the distance, we in fact ran 31 miles together one day.
And then he passed out.
At the end of the workout, he said, "Women have hidden potential in endurance and stamina." He was so impressed with me that he helped me sign up for the Boston Marathon.
Now, when you signed up for the Boston Marathon, I've read your account of it, and it doesn't sound like you even had to declare your gender. No women ran Boston, but was there even a rule that stipulated that you couldn't?
No, but they said such a rule existed, and it didn't, because we went through the rule book, because I was saying, well, why aren't other women there? And Arnie, my coach, said, you know, it's because they, you know, they're afraid, and they haven't done this training, and the officials don't think any woman in her right mind would want to run a marathon, so it's not against the rules. It wasn't in the rule book, nothing about gender on the entry form. It would never have occurred to them, really, because, you know, women didn't run. So when I signed up for the race, I signed my name, by the way. I always signed my name K.V. Switzer with my initials. That's because I wanted to be a really good writer. I wanted to be J.D. Salinger, and also because my name is oddly spelled. So I signed K.V. Switzer, and obviously when the entry form went in, they thought it was from a guy. And I wasn't trying to defraud them. I just, you know, wanted to do everything correct and fill out the form and send in my $2 entry fee, which is another joke, you know, because the entry fee for Boston is, I think, what, $200 now. But anyway, you know, there we were in Boston, and I pinned on my bib, and I was very proud of myself, and the guys all in the race were wonderful to me.
Right. They were incredibly supportive. And you didn't do anything to hide your gender. You put your hair in a ponytail. You wore lipstick.
No, I didn't even put my hair in a ponytail. Okay. I had it down with a nice headband, and I had my lipstick on and my little gold earrings, so and eyeliner. So, you know, but here's the deal. That day, it was snowing and sleeting. And we all had on heavy gray warm-up suits to stay warm. I mean, really, if it had been warm weather, we might not be having this conversation because I would have been in shorts and a cute little top and looked nice, and I would have probably been pulled right at the starting line. But instead, I was in a baggy gray warm-up suit, and from a distance, I looked like one of the guys. And the officials just pushed us into the starting pen, and the gun went off, and down the street we went. And it wasn't until 2 miles into the race when the press truck came by us, and they saw a girl in the race wearing a bib number. The race, they were taking pictures like crazy. And the race director, who was on the press truck, lost his temper, jumped off the truck, ran down the street and attacked me and tried to throw me out of the race. And he tried to rip off those bib numbers. And as you said, that bib number, in fact, was 261. So those pictures were flashed around the world. And in fact,
are still flashed around the world. Still,
again and again. And it is, in fact, the picture is in Time Life's 100 photos that changed the world. Because everybody resonates with a story, and they're galvanized by these photos, and they resonate with the story of being told you're not welcome or you're not good enough. And here's, you know, a girl running, and he's just trying to throw her out of the race because she's a girl.
If you had not been attacked by the race director that day, if you had just been allowed to run unmolested, do you think that running the Boston Marathon would have had the impact that it had?
I'll tell you what, not the impact it would have had, but certainly I would have devoted my life to creating opportunities for women in running because it was so empowering to me, and I knew that other women would really, really love running if they only had a welcoming opportunity. But to tell the truth, that photograph has been an astonishing vehicle. It is one of the most galvanizing photos now in the history of the women's rights movement because what happened is it politicized, the incident politicized women's running and caught the world's attention. So it really sped up the process, that's for sure.
After you ran Boston, and it wasn't your goal to change the world that day you wanted to run a marathon and prove that you could do it. But after you ran Boston and those pictures were flashed all over the world, you ended up becoming an elite runner, really, in the brand new world of elite running, elite marathon running for women. Tell me what happened after Boston. How did you start to train, and what did you want to do with that momentum, that moment?
Absolutely. You know, I entered the race. I often say I started that Boston Marathon as a girl and I finished it as a grown woman. Yeah, I was just there to run a race, just to run. But as soon as the official attacked me, it became something else. It did become a political act. And I knew I had, first of all, to finish the race, no matter what. Even on my hands and knees, I was going to finish the race. So I was one determined lady. When I finished in 4 hours and 20 minutes, I knew I was going to be pilloried for doing a jogging time. Can you imagine? I was jogging in those days. And I wanted to become a better athlete, one, because I had a chip on my shoulder, and two, because I wanted to explore my physical limits. I wanted to know what I could do. When I trained down to winning the New York City Marathon and ran a 2-hour and 51-minute marathon, then people really paid me a lot of respect as an athlete. And that was really important because it gave me credibility as something else besides being a rabble-rouser, right? And also it opened my eyes to the limitlessness potential that existed out there with women who didn't even know they had abilities. And I knew if I could just give them the opportunity, that ability would come out. And the opportunities not only came from me creating a series of global races with excellent sponsorship around the world. You know, I had races in 27 countries eventually. But we could gather the data and statistics and the enthusiasm and the performances from those events and present it to the International Olympic Committee and got the women's marathon included in the Olympic Games. When I started that drive, people said, you are out of your mind. You'll never get the marathon for women in the Olympic Games. There are too many traditional countries. But we went to those traditional countries, and we put on events that proved that women would absolutely come out of the woodwork and run. Now, in my own lifetime, in North America, there are more women runners than men. This is spreading to Europe, and it's a social revolution. You know, it's not about these women wanting to be Olympic athletes or to run fast. They're really there because it empowers them and it changes their lives. And in many countries, it's changing the social fabric.
When you became the face of women's running after you ran the Boston Marathon, did women come out of the woodwork to talk to you and say, hey, I run too?
In the early days, yes. There were groups that came to me and said, if I run and I'll run with you, I'm afraid to go by myself. Would you do this? And I started women's only races, too, in 1972 so that they would not be intimidated. But also, this is the sad part of the story, but now it's turned happy. Many women were really terrible to me. Women were more terrible to me than men. And that's because many people would rather live with the devil they know rather than take a risk and try something new, try an alternative. And they were afraid of me because I was free and powerful. And I wanted to introduce them so badly to running.
And we're going to have to leave it there for just a moment. We'll be back in 2 minutes. I'm talking with Catherine Switzer, who became the first woman to officially enter and run the Boston Marathon in 1967. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in just about 15 minutes, I'll talk with Terry Gilliam, one of the founding members of Monty Python, the only American in that group. He'll be in Iowa City tomorrow. Right now, my guest is Catherine Switzer. In 1967, she became the first woman to officially enter and run the Boston Marathon. She has had a long career as an elite runner, as an author, as a broadcaster. She spent last weekend in Des Moines for the Des Moines Marathon. She's also the founder of the nonprofit 261 Fearless. And Catherine, before the break, we were talking about how women responded after you ran that first Boston Marathon. And you said that you got a lot of negative reaction, which really does surprise me to hear. But How was that expressed? Were you getting letters from women saying, what are you doing? What happened?
Charity, you know, it was 50-50. There would be women who'd say, you're my Joan of Arc. I've got your picture on my mantelpiece. And there were other women who said, I did the wrong thing and I shouldn't have done that. Women don't run. And actually, I knew that if I could only introduce running to those negative women, that they would come around. And indeed, many of them came to me when they turned 30, 40 and said, boy, I was so wrong. I love running. It's changed my life. So it was only a matter of time. You know, people are afraid of change. And I wanted to really help these women, and we've done it. You know, there are more women runners now in the United States and in North America, in fact, than men. And as I said before, that's a social revolution. It's an empowerment revolution, and they are so excited about what they are doing and what they feel.
Now, you feel that running for women is different than running for men. Why do you think that is?
Because men want to go fast, and they're generally competitive, and that's fine. And I'm not saying that there aren't some women who are competitive. I was very competitive. I wanted to go fast. I wanted to train hard. But most women really run for stress relief, weight loss, and also for the community and friendship of other women. You know, you on the road, when you're running with somebody, you tell them the secret of your soul, and it never goes further than the road. It's really a wonderful companionship. But for physiological, emotional, and real physiological reasons, too, the act of running is very transformational and gives you a sense of empowerment. You know, it's really quite magical. It is like the sense of confidence and accomplishment is tremendous.
Now, you talk about the social aspect of running, and knowing a number of runners, I know a lot more women who do run with running buddies, who run in groups than men, although I do know men who do that as well. Do you feel like that social aspect is an important part of the act? I mean, not everybody run with others.
Yeah, I think the social aspect is a critical part for women because they love being together and sharing the effort and sharing the accomplishment. That's why 261 Fearless, my nonprofit, which is named after that bib number, by the way, in the Boston Marathon that the official tried to rip off me. And I'll tell you in a minute how this nonprofit began. But these women really share in this sense of global empowerment, and they feel fearless, and they want to reach out to other women who are fearful about taking that first step or are even in a fearful situation.
In some ways, it strikes me, you're talking about with men, there can be more of the competition. In a way, it seems that women have a little more freedom because just finishing a run feels like a bigger accomplishment than maybe it would for a man.
You know, first of all, I think every guy who starts running and running long wants to finish, you know, be able to finish too. And he's not embarrassed anymore when a woman beats him, okay? But guys also want to always get better and faster. Not always, but I would say almost always. I'm not saying it's not empowering for men, because it is very empowering for men. But it gives them a sense of strength and competitiveness, perhaps, that women don't have necessarily. So, yeah, I think it is different. But the other thing is this, is men and women running together, they're not competitive with each other. They run together as friends, as comrades, as teammates. And it's really amazing socially. And this is the social revolution part, because I think often for the first time through running, men and women don't regard each other sexually or violently. They're regarding each other as a teammate, as friends. Just runners.
Now, one of the things that I have seen change in my lifetime, and like I said, I've always been able to take it for granted that women can run and participate. But when I was a kid and my family was involved in a lot of running events, people who weren't what you would consider to be athletes, people who you wouldn't look at and say, oh, that person is a runner, they didn't come to those events. And now when you go to a race or a run, you see people of all shapes and sizes at all levels of fitness. The whole world of running seems to have become much more open and egalitarian. Do you see that reflected in the events that you attend and that you put on?
Isn't it fabulous? Absolutely. And one of the things that has helped make this happen are things like the IMT Des Moines Marathon or the New York City Marathon or London or these big mega races. When the race goes through town, people standing on the sidelines clapping look at some of these people and say, my word, if they can do that, I can do that. You know, they see people without legs. They see people on crutches. They see people in wheelchairs. They see people who weigh 500 pounds. You know, they say, hey, I can do that. And it really is changing. And it's really, as you say, egalitarian. We don't judge each other. Runners do not judge each other. It is really amazing.
Another change that we've seen in recent years is that the half marathon has gotten to be an incredibly popular race distance. Why do you think that that distance has become, for so many people, their goal post?
Actually, the people who are driving the half marathon are women. And I'll tell you why. It's because with women, running also is a time management issue. And that's one reason they have gravitated to running, because it's cheap, easy, convenient, and totally time accessible. I mean, if you have 10 minutes in the morning and 10 minutes at noon and 10 minutes in the afternoon, you get a 30-minute run in the day. You can fit it in between, you know, picking up the kids from school or from daycare. You can, and running clothes now are so neat that you can wear them to pick up the kid, go for the run, and still stop at Starbucks. You know, so it's not like it used to be with crummy old clothes.
Right.
You know, it's really nice. But yeah, definitely the half marathon though for women gives the same huge buzz because it uses the word marathon, which is a very romantic, glamorous name. The same buzz of going the distance. You know, when you go long, you get a lot more endorphins shot through your body. You have these great mood enhancers. And yet you don't have to make a commitment of like a 3 or 4 hour run on every weekend to train for it. The marathon distance of 26 miles, 385 yards, requires a lot of training. In fact, you don't get through the distance without heavy training. But a half marathon, you don't do exactly half the training, but you can do a lot less and you can still get that wonderful marathon buzz.
I'm talking to marathon woman Catherine Switzer. She is the founder recently of the nonprofit 261 Fearless, and she spent last weekend in Des Moines for the Des Moines Marathon. Of course, she's also the author of many books. She's been a broadcaster and an elite competitor herself for many years. And I want to go back to your dad inspired you to start running. And you did mention earlier Girls on the Run, which is an international organization for elementary age girls, third through sixth grade, that it's a 10-week program or a 12-week program that culminates in the girls running a 5K, and it is something that I'm involved in personally. And you've been traveling around doing a lot of events for different Girls on the Run chapters around the country. When your dad started you running, when you were 12 years old, he said you should run a mile a day. Where did that come from?
You know, he saw an insecure little kid who wanted to make the field hockey team in her high school. And I was a year ahead of everybody, and I was going to be in high school at age 12. So he saw that I was afraid to even try. And he said, honey, if you ran a mile a day, you'd make that field hockey team. You'd be one of the best players. And so he measured off the yard, and it was 7 laps, and he got me out there running that mile every day. And I was so excited that I could do it, and I did make the team. But it gave me, I always say this, it gave me a victory under my belt that every day that nobody could take away from me. Growing up with this amazing sense of empowerment, it really gave me a platform for the rest of my life. That's one reason why I love Girls on the Run, because it gives all of those girls, first of all, from every socioeconomic background, to come together, to treat each other equally, and to have a little victory under their belt that will empower them for the rest of their lives. It's really phenomenal. I encourage every parent who's listening to this or anybody who has any touch with any child to give them an opportunity just to try and to tell them that they can do it.
One of the keys of that program is that it is a non-competitive program. And of course, you know, there are opportunities for girls and boys to run cross country and track and all kinds of opportunities to run these days. Why do you think having an opportunity to run in a non-competitive environment can be powerful?
Because you have support of a team, of a group, And I think when you go forward in life, you realize that, you know, even though you may be a powerful individual, you really need a support system. And it's also fun. And I think that is really, really critical when we go into a competitive world to have people that you know you can trust, who are around you as friends, who are not judgmental, and also can give you advice and be friends and be fun.
You sponsor a lot of women's only events, and you're not the only person who sponsors women's only running events. Why in a day and age when, 58% of women or 58% of people who sign up for races are women, why do you think there is a place still for women's only events?
I get asked this question so much, and of course I also get chastised a lot for it because they say, you were the person who broke the gender barrier at the Boston Marathon. How could you possibly organize a women's only run? It goes back to the fear factor, and that's why my nonprofit is 261 Fearless, because people are often afraid to take the first step. If you go to a park, you'll see thousands of women running, but most of them are afraid to take that first step because they think they're going to go into the New York City Marathon or the IMT Des Moines Marathon, and it's competitive, and that everybody's going to judge you about how slow you are, and they're always saying, I don't want to be last. When on a women's only race, it's non-intimidating and welcoming, and we don't judge each other. We applaud the winners. We applaud the world-class event athletes, but we don't care. You know, just get in there and do it.
Given that you're providing an environment for women to run women's only events, how would you feel about a men's only event in this day and age?
If I won the lottery charity, I would put it on tomorrow. I love having men's only events. I think that men deserve their forum just as much as women do. And in fact, one of the things I feel about girls on the run, I think we're going to soon need little boys on the run too, because I think boys need empowerment as much as girls do. And I just think that there's room for this. I love this race in New York City where it's called the Healthy Kidney Run, sponsored by the Kidney Foundation, the prize money is mostly for men, is for men, whereas the women have their mini 10K, and that's for them. So they have an opportunity to excel with their own competition.
Although men and women and boys and girls all still, you know, have the opportunities to compete in running events, there are some differences. For example, in Iowa, girls run 2.5 miles in cross country. The boys run 3 in high school cross country. How do you feel about a difference like that?
Well, you know, the sad thing about that is that women actually excel in endurance and stamina events. So actually, the longer the event, the better suited they are for it. So the shorter ones, it sort of diminishes their own capability. So certainly, I would love to see the distances extended for women. This is an issue also in Canada, and I get asked about it all the time. And you just sort of throw up your hands. You know, we have all the medical evidence that shows that when it comes to 100 miles or a 24-hour run or 6-day runs, women win outright. So when the distance gets longer, let's give them the shot at it to excel.
Where do you think there still needs to be work on? I mean, obviously, with 261 Fearless, you're working very hard on empowering women. What are the needs that remain? You mentioned that in the United States, there are more women runners than men, but in other countries, that is lagging. What are your main goals for the future?
Well, with the 261 Fearless Foundation, I think we're going to be able to reach women globally that we have never been able to reach before, not only because of the nonprofit, but because everybody, regardless of their language or country, looks at that picture and they understand what that feels like. And thanks to mobile devices and the internet, we're going to be able to communicate this now like we never have before and give women the ability to take part in clubs, in training programs, in events, and mostly a platform of communicating with each other, fearless women reaching out to fearful women. And so, you know, we live in many ways in North America in a dream world. There are women in the Mideast who can't even go out of their house alone, who can't drive a car, who are not allowed an education, who can't even get a passport. Women in North Africa who are incredibly poverty situations. And can running help them? Absolutely, because freedom really begins when you can take control of your own body and your own movement. And so if you can't go out of the house alone, you either can run virtually in your heart by communicating with other women, or you can run on a treadmill, or you can run in your room, you know, up and down. It is astonishing. So when you ask where we have to go, we have a huge amount of work to go. Most of the women in the world live in a fearful situation, most. And if we can reach them in any way through this, we've done a great service to them.
This afternoon, when I get done with work, I will go to my Girls on the Run practice, and I'll sit down with 33 girls who are on my team. If you had the opportunity to look at these elementary school girls and share one message with them, what would you say to them?
I would say you can do anything. Never sell yourself short. You can just sometimes by putting one foot in front of the other, you will understand that and realize that, and it will come through to you.
When you think about all of the things you've accomplished in your career, what is the thing you are most proud of?
It's interesting that you ask that, because I used to say it was getting the women's marathon into the Olympic Games because of television that was broadcast to the whole world, and everybody knew now that women could run this amazing distance. Now it's the thing I'm going to be most proud of is going to be the legacy of the 261 Fearless Inc. nonprofit, of reaching women who have never been reached before and showing them how to be fearless.
Catherine, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Charity.
Catherine Switzer became the first woman to officially enter and run the Boston Marathon in 1967. She went on to have a career as an elite competitor. She is an author and a broadcaster, and she's the founder of the nonprofit 261 Fearless. Coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with Terry Gilliam, one of the founding members of Monty Python. He's also the only member of Monty Python to hail from the United States, spending the first 12 years of his life living in Minnesota. He'll be in Iowa City tomorrow evening as part of the University of Iowa Lecture Series. I'll be interviewing him on stage tomorrow night at the Iowa Memorial Union at 7:30. It's an event that is open to the public. That's coming up in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.
And now for something completely different.
Monty Python's a flying circus.
Growing up in Minnesota and California, no one would have predicted that Terry Gilliam would become one of the most beloved entertainers in British history. He's one of the founding members of Monty Python. Rarely seen on screen himself, his artwork and animations defined the look of the group and inspired many imitators. He also co-directed Monty Python and the Holy Grail and many other post-Python films, including Time Bandits, Brazil, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. He's written a new memoir, Gilliam-esque, and he'll be in Iowa City tomorrow. I'll be interviewing him on stage at the Iowa Memorial Union at 7:30 as part of the University of Iowa Lecture Series, and he is with me on the line today. Good morning, Terry.
Hi, hi.
You know, we like to claim you as a Midwesterner since you were born in Minnesota, but you moved to Los Angeles pretty young in life, and you did kind of get exposed to the film scene, to Hollywood there. What were some of the first things that kind of drew you into that arena?
Well, it was odd. I mean, even though we actually moved out there when I was about 12, I think the first years sort of built up my fascination with storytelling, show business, all of those things, so that when we got out to California and discovered there were no cowboys and Indians still roaming the plains out there, I guess I gravitated towards kids, particularly in high school, where a lot of the kids were from families where the parents worked in the film business as technicians and other things. And it was always fascinating because their lives were quite different from what normal people live, because they you know, they were near the stars, or they had touched the stars, and they knew the secrets of filmmaking, and that was really magical to me, and I just gravitated towards those kids.
One of the things that I really enjoy about your book is that it has lots and lots of pictures. That's always good. But you seem to have saved scraps of paper from the beginning of your life to share at this point. And so you share some very early drawings that you did. When did you start to find that drawing was a really powerful outlet for you?
It was one of those things I just did as a kid. You didn't think about it. You just did it. And rather than being drawing, you know, in a fine art kind of way, you figure drawing and all this, I gravitated towards cartooning because cartooning is more immediate when it comes to feedback. You draw something funny, and then the kids laugh at you, and they think you're very clever. So that's why you then continue to draw more cartoons, and pretty soon you find yourself, you know, becoming a professional.
Well, and that was something you did quite a lot of in high school. And then in college, at Occidental College, you found yourself spending a lot of time working on a magazine on campus. Tell me a little bit about that experience.
Well, Occidental College was a really rather special place because it was quite small. There's only, I think, 1,200 students here. And they were either incredibly intelligent or incredibly rich. So it was an exciting mixture of people. A group of us took over the Literary magazine, which published beautiful poetry and lovely art, and turned it into the Humor magazine on the campus.
Which made it broadly read, I think.
Yes, it was much more successful. And lower the tone and go and become successful was what we learned. And we became really, the court jesters there at school. And it expanded beyond the magazine. We were constantly inventing things, painting posters, just generally making life on canvas a kind of a cabaret in a strange way. And I think I learned more doing that than I did in all my academic courses. It was great. It was a great time because where the magazine had only been, I think, three or four issues a year, we upped it to six. We were all very ambitious. It's when you become the entertainers that life really gets interesting, and people would wait to get the next issue of the magazine because we were going to be doing outrageous things, and we were constantly getting in trouble with the dean of students because we pushed the limits, we caused trouble and havoc sometimes, and we even ran we ran them for student body president and ran the most outrageous, virulent presidential campaign imaginable, much to the chagrin of the authorities, because they took politics seriously and we didn't and have never taken it seriously subsequently.
You spent time there, you traveled abroad, and then you ended up in advertising for a couple of years. And I take it you were pretty successful at what you were doing, but you also really seemed to want to get out. Did you even know what you wanted at that point? Did you know where you wanted to get out to?
No. Well, at that point, when I got into advertising, I had hitchhiked around Europe. Help magazine eventually failed, and I hitchhiked around for about 5 months in Europe and fell in love with the place. I just thought, you know, all these very varying cultures, there was, you know, history was all around me. And I came back to the States to decide whether I wanted to stay in the States or not. And that's when I spent that year in advertising out in Los Angeles. And I wanted out. I didn't like advertising. My girlfriend was British. She wanted to return to England. And I said, great, we're out of here. And that was 1967. I left America and never came back.
You have said that you feel like if you didn't leave America at that point, you would have become a bomb-throwing, protesting terrorist.
I would have been a terrorist.
Do you really believe that, or is that a line?
No, I felt it. I don't know if I believed it. I certainly felt it. My anger was that great that I was angry, frustrated. I hated what America was becoming. I hated the war in Vietnam. And I thought, you know, as a kid, you're growing up believing in truth, justice, and the American way. And I didn't see any of that in reality. Anti-war protesters were being beaten up in the streets. And, black kids were being lynched in the South. It was just, you know, I hated it. And so, yes, I just knew life in America was not really for me. When I get that frustrated and angry, I do think I'm capable of very dangerous things. And I've always been very good throughout my life making sure I don't go to that extreme and get out before trouble is caused.
Now, when you moved to England, there, of course, you had to work to stay alive, to make a living, and yep. Did a number of different jobs. But you had made a connection with John Cleese, who, of course, also one of the founding members of Monty Python. You had made a connection with him when you were in New York working on Help magazine. You hired him to do photo shoots, basically, for Help magazine when he was in the United States doing a comedy review that was struggling a bit. When you were in England and looking for an outlet for your artwork, how did you reconnect with John Cleese?
Well, I mean, I was in England. I was working, still magazine work is what I was doing, whether it's cartoon, illustration, or I was also the art editor of a magazine. But I just knew this is not what I wanted to do. And John, by that point, had become very well-known in television. And I just called him and said, you know, introduce me to somebody in television. I need to get out of this other business I'm in. And eventually I did meet a producer via John. It took months before I could really contact this guy or made a connection. And he was producing a children's comedy show called Do Not Adjust Your Set that was written and performed by Michael Palin, Terry Jones, and Eric Idle, along with his Bonzo Dog Doodah Band. And he, this producer, was an amateur cartoonist and actually liked my cartoons. But I think being sympathetic, he bought a couple of my written sketches and forced them on the others in the group, and that was my connection with the half of my Monty Python. And within a year, we combined with John and Graham Chapman, and the BBC gave us 7 shows and see what you can do with it, boys. And I guess we did well enough to be talking about it today.
With your artwork and your animations in Monty Python's Flying Circus, I mean, they are so much a part of the show, so much, so define really the look of the show. And they were something, of course, the whole thing was something completely different. But the animations and your artwork really reinforce the newness of what all of you were doing on screen. And I get the impression you were doing a lot of that kind of in isolation. Did you work pretty much on your own?
Yeah, basically I did. The way it would work, I mean, everybody, we worked, I mean, Mike and Terry wrote together, John and Graham wrote together, Eric wrote on his own, and I did my stuff on my own. And what would happen, everybody would write a lot of material. Then we would have a big group meeting and go through all the material and decide what went into the shows, which bits would go with other bits in which shows. All of this would be worked out. My stuff was always a bit an anomaly because I could never explain what I was doing to the satisfaction of the others. So they just let me get on with it. And they didn't really know what I was doing until the day we were in the studio with the audience. And I would arrive with cans of my films and they would go in the show. And I think that to me, still the miracle is that they worked and integrated so beautifully with it. We just seemed to be on the same wavelength, all of us, except they were doing what they did, which is verbal and performing, and I was doing it in cartoon fashion. And And yeah, and you're right when you say it did define the show, because nobody had seen animation like that, and then integrated as it was, because it also was part of the idea early on. I had done a cartoon for another show, well, for Dada Jachisette, which was basically just a stream of consciousness, a bit of animation. So we decided to keep the show like that. We would not have sketches that ended in a punchline. We would reach a point when the sketch was no longer working and get out of it before that moment arrived by handing the problem over to me to connect to the next sketch. And I really enjoyed it because it gave me a start point and an end point, but between those two points I could go wherever I wanted to go.
When you were doing something that was so new at the time, and I think about all of the, I don't know, maybe not imitators, the people who've been inspired by that work. I mean, you see it everywhere now. I mean, on British comedy shows, but American comedy shows, in movies, all over the place. When you look around and you see all of these people who have taken inspiration from your ideas and your work, what does that feel like to you?
It's great. The more they steal from me, the more proud I feel. No, it's just wonderful that you've actually, one has had influence, because I think of all the people that influence me. And this is what we do. I love this. What I think is great about art is, you know, you pass on to others who then take it further or a slightly different angle. That's all we do. There's very little originality out there. It's just everything is just passed on from foot to mouth or hand to mouth. I think foot in mouth is what I used to do.
So
it's great.
Right now, of course, celebrating the 40th anniversary of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, the movie you co-directed with Terry Jones. And, of course, you also appear in that in various ways, and your animations and illustrations appear in that. Occasionally, you've expressed a little bit of tedium at the fact that we are still talking about Monty Python 40, 45 years later. But when you think about the fact that people are still engaged and so moved by the work that you did 40 years ago, what does that make you think about that work? How does that change your idea of what you did do?
I don't think about it much. I really don't, because it complicates my life. It makes, well, two things. It makes me, what have I done subsequently? Wasted all those years? I don't know. I think all I really feel about it is that we were very lucky to be at the BBC at a time when they were laissez-faire, let us do what we wanted. We weren't surrounded by bureaucrats and executives and nervous managers. It was six guys making each other laugh. And there was a purity in that that I thought was fantastic, and which, you know, is very hard to replicate. It doesn't happen now. It's so much more difficult for people. Admittedly, you know, you can go onto the web and do whatever you want and reach people. That's quite nice. But it's not the same as it was when we were doing TV, because at that point in Britain, there were only three channels. So we would go out on a Sunday night, and on Monday morning, everybody in every office, in every shop, was talking about Monty Python. Now, that's extraordinary to be that central to the communal thinking, and that's great. And so, I mean, all I know is if it wasn't for Python, you and I would not be talking now. So it changed my life completely and allowed me to do all the things that I've done subsequently. So it's great.
Terry Gilliam, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Great, and we'll see you tomorrow night.
Yes. Thanks a lot, sir.
Thanks.
Terry Gilliam, one of the founders of Monty Python. He has written a new memoir called Gilliam-esque, and he will be in Iowa City tomorrow. I will be interviewing him on stage at the Iowa Memorial Union at 7:30 p.m. as part of the University of Iowa Lecture Series. It is free and open to the public.
Monty Python's a flying circus.
Hi. Talk of Iowa is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, Dennis Reese, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.